Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Mike Stark, writer, journalist, and creative director for the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about his book, Chasing the Ghost Bear, On the Trail of America's Lost Super Beast. Mike Stark, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
I have to say, there are certain books, you know, I read about three or four books a week thoroughly, and there are certain books that were just enjoyable, and I just, like, can't put them down. This is one of them, and it's because of my childhood fascination with creatures of the Pleistocene. How did you, who's not a paleontologist, start down this obsessive trail?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not a paleontologist. I'm not a scientist.
But you play one on TV.
Exactly. So don't tell anybody. my career has been, as a journalist and working for daily newspapers and was a journalist for the Associated Press for a while. But, you know, before I became a journalist, I was somebody who loved to be outside. I've always loved thinking and looking at wildlife. I love being where wildlife are, occupying the same territory and space with them, whether it's hiking or camping or going out to the nearest, wild place, wherever my house is at the time. But bears have always had a special place for me, mm-hmm. Like I think they do for a lot of people.
If you've ever seen a bear face to face, you're changed. Even just a black bear. I mean, we have black bears here in New England, and every time I see a black bear, I get mesmerized, and it's a problem because I start to want to follow it. Now, black bears aren't the problem that grizzly bears are, but they're sort of more like drunken frat boys around here. But but you don't follow a bear. Just the way they walk and their solid appearance. I mean, there's something wild about a bear seems so sturdy, so solid that they leave a lasting impression.
They really do. And I think that I think there's a couple things why we look at bears differently maybe than a lot of other animals. One is I think there's a humanistic aspect to them. There can be where their faces kind of look like they could be human faces if you looked at them the right way. Their posture, the way they sometimes will lean against a tree, sit on their rump and kind of lean back. And I think the way they handle their families, their cubs. I think sometimes if you've seen a mother bear with cubs, you've seen her kind of shooing them down the trail like you would see, a mother with her kids at the baseball game trying to keep them in line going to their seats. So, and then I think the other aspect is it helps you understand your place in the world because bears, especially the big ones, help you understand that humans are not always the dominant species on the planet, and these are creatures who have territory and, we could be their food at some point.
Now, this book is about the giant short-faced bear, an extinct species of bear found in North America that was the largest flesh-eating mammal in North America. It is amazingly an impressive creature.
They were massive, Mark. They were, could weigh up to a ton. And if it was standing on all fours, it would look a six-foot person right in the face. And then standing up, they might get 10 to 11 feet tall. And then with, if they're reaching up with one of their arms, that gets them to, say 14, 15 feet tall.
Wow.
So they were huge animals.
Now, one of the points that comes up as several points in your book is, the woolly mammoth and the woolly rhinoceros and even the giant ground sloth all get their due. Like, there are toys about them. There's all sorts of decorations about them. But for some reason, this huge, amazing creature has been sort of lost to us.
It slipped through our fingers at some point. And it's fascinating that culturally, we don't know who this bear was, and we haven't for a long time, even though it shared the landscape with all these other more famous Pleistocene creatures, the saber-toothed cats and the mammoths. And, bears are sort of elusive beings, and they move across the landscape, and they can be in a fairly quiet way. And part of me wonders if the giant short-faced bear just exited stage left without anybody really noticing.
We're going to talk about that in a second, but let's talk about the bear for physically for a second. The body proportions on this creature are very different from the bears that we're familiar with. The legs are really, really long, and the face is, in fact, pushed in a bit.
That's right. Yeah, these were, in some ways, some people have called these bears the bulldog bears, and I think that's partially because they did have kind of a scrunched-up snout. But their body was really, yeah, you're right, it was not like a lot of other bears that we know. They didn't have the really giant rump that we think of, like with grizzly bears and with black bears. They were more slender. I feel like they were a little bit more almost cat-like in their body type, but they were huge, as I say. They were really big animals, and so they had a very specific body type kind of that evolved for their lifestyle.
One of the great things about this book is you follow a trail for wherever fossils of the giant short-faced bear showed up. And that in itself is a weird story. But one of the first places you visit is the Potter Creek Cave in Shasta Lake, Northern California. Can you talk about that place physically? Because you go into that cave, and it sounded really scary. It sounds bizarre.
Yeah, this was a cave in the Shasta Mountains in Northern California. And I was there because that was where the first skull of a short-faced bear was ever found. It was found in 1879 in Potter Creek Cave by a guy named James Richardson. But this is not a cave that you can just kind of walk up to and find. It's hidden on a hillside. It's on U.S. Forest Service property at this point. So to get there, we had to take a boat across Shasta Lake and then just work our way kind of bushwhacking up the mountain to the entrance to this cave, and it was maybe an hour, hour and a half walk to get up to the cave entrance. And from there, it's a big kind of wide mouth, and walk to the back of the cave. It's sort of like a funnel, and then there's just a little chute you climb up to, and you have to belly crawl through a narrow chute that's maybe 2.5-3 feet tall. And then
okay, hold on there, Mike. Have you done a lot of caving before?
No. I was nervous.
Okay.
I don't like tight spaces.
Tight dark spaces. It's not just tight spaces. It's tight dark spaces.
Yeah, and there's still animals living there. There's still bats and all sorts of other cave creatures in there.
And there's like pits.
And there's pits in there, yeah. So you get in there and you start to shine a light around. And yeah, you're in this whole cathedral. Wow. Space of these narrow chutes and big rooms. So yeah, it was eerie to be in there.
Now, this is important because it's who first discovered the first remains of the short-faced bear.
So it was first the first skull was found by this guy Richardson in 1879, and he was just a guy working at a local fish hatchery there, not far from the cave. And a few months later, the skull ended up in the hands of a paleontologist named Edward Drinker Cope, who at the time was sort of a famous dinosaur hunter who had come out west to look for dinosaurs in Oregon. And he got the skull and put some time into really measuring it and looking at it and trying to understand what it was. So he was the first one to provide a scientific description of what he thought this bear was.
You end up seeing several skulls throughout the course of this book. The skulls are massive, and especially the teeth.
Yeah, I was able to hold a few casts in my hand of them, and they're as big as holding a small baby, in your arms. They're really, really big, and once you start to think about the lives that these bears lived, whose skull you're holding in your hand, they're an incredible species to behold.
What are their relationships? Are they related to the black bears and the grizzly bears that we have today?
Loosely. So they are in the bear family, but those bears you mentioned are part of the Ursus branch of the bear family. Giant short-faced bears were part of the Tremarctinae branch of bears, and so it has one living relative, which is the spectacled bear in South America. So you could say that they were giant short-faced bears were maybe cousins to black bears and grizzlies, but a slightly different branch of the family.
And this brings up the Pleistocene in North America. And you write a lot about the Pleistocene. It was in between the Ice Ages. And I forget who it was in your book, described it as biotic turmoil in slow motion. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the Pleistocene was incredibly tumultuous time here in North America and elsewhere around the world, because going through terrific, massive changes. And a lot of it was because there were these periods of icing and de-icing. You know, massive glaciers would show up and, you know, they would tower a mile high and then they would shrink back down again, go back up. So you have these periods of really boom and bust cycles. And the vegetation was trying its best to keep up, to adapt to these changing environments. And the animals were too. And so you saw a period where animals just got massive during that time.
Yeah.
And so that's how we have, you know, Columbian mammoths and mastodons and giant beavers and giant sloths and giant short-faced bears. So you had this kind of almost cartoonish ballooning of certain species getting really, really big, and we haven't, you know, seen anything like that. But there was just a moment, you know, of a couple million years where really, really big animals were walking around North America.
And it's always fascinating. Ever since a kid, I mean, I was originally into dinosaurs, then I found out about prehistoric mammals, and this period in North America, the fauna, if you had gone back in time, rivaled everything that was in Africa that we see today with elephants and stuff like that. There were these giant ground sloths, which were wild creatures. Then there were the armadillos, the glyptodonts, which were like tanks. There was even a giant beaver.
Can you imagine?
I know. Can you imagine? And it was just this amazing time period in North American wildlife, and this is where the bear lived, the giant short-faced bear. The other thing is, how do these fossils end up in these caves? Like we were talking about how tough it is to get into the cave in Potter Creek Cave. Well, and they're at the bottom of this huge thing. How did the animals get in there? And there were a lot of other fossils in there too. But how do the animals manage to get into that cave?
Yeah, Potter Creek Cave is full of, you know, species of, you know, 50, 100 different animals, and 20 of them at least were extinct species. So there are modern species in there, but also, you know, bones of Pleistocene species. The speculation is, I mean, to be honest, nobody really knows how these bear bones ended up at the bottom of this cave, but they did.
Isn't there like a suggestion that there was sort of like an opening up above and they sort of fell down in there?
Exactly. So you can imagine a bear just wandering along a mountain ridge in search of some tasty food, and it's following its nose like bears do, maybe not exactly watching where it's going, and fell through a hole in the ground, and little did it know that it, you know, that hole ended up down at the bottom of a cave. So that's one suggestion that about how those ended up there.
It seems like those tight spaces that you were crawling through, though, the bear wouldn't have been able to make it through.
I think it'd be tough. Yeah, it'd be very, very tough. So I think that theory about them coming in some other way through a hole somewhere at the top is probably right.
What I love is throughout this book, you meet paleontologists and other researchers. Julie Meacham is doing research at another cave, Natural Trap Cave in Wyoming. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating cave in Wyoming. And Julie's a fascinating scientist. She was great to talk to. This was a cave also with a hole at the top of the top of a ridge, and animals were falling down into it. It's about an 80-foot fall for those animals.
Jeez.
And they just piled up at the bottom of the cave over tens of thousands of years, different kinds of animals. And it's been a great snapshot for scientists to be able to go in there and sift their way down through the layers and see who was living in that that part of the country during that time. And so there are, you know, different kinds of wolves in there. There were camels and horses and mammoths, but also giant short-faced bears. And talking to Julie, the only way to get for her and her team to get down to this cave is they had to put themselves into a harness and be lowered down into it. So, you know, having to be really trusting your crewmates there as they lower you down to the cave. And then once you're down there, it's cold, it's clammy, it's like being in a refrigerator. But the advantage is that refrigerator has preserved these bones for thousands and thousands of years. So it's really been a treasure trove for Julie and other people looking at that cave.
When they're pulling out these bones, have these bones actually been fossilized, or are they just preserved bones? If you know what I mean, have they been converted to minerals, or are they actually the original bone material?
It depends. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. It really depends on what kind of materials they've been stored in.
One of my favorite places that you visited is the La Brea Tar Pits. Now, that I went to L.A., I tried to find the La Brea Tar Pits, and I couldn't find them. So I never got a chance to go, and I've always been fascinated. For people who have never been there, talk to me about what it's like. I mean, it sounds like it's a big sideshow attraction.
It's incredible. I mean, part of what's incredible is it's smack in the middle of Los Angeles.
I know.
Los Angeles. And so right off, you know, near Wilshire Boulevard. And, you know, so it's very out of place for the rest of Los Angeles. So what it is right now is it's a county park. And so, you know, there's open space and, you know, grass and a few trails and stuff. And there's this incredible museum there on site. The museum has all sorts of displays of the animals that have been pulled out of the La Brea tar pits for the last 125 years or so. Part of what's fascinating is there is still tar bubbling up to the surface.
Wow.
Outside of the building. And so, you know, you sit on the grass to have your lunch, and, you know, you're liable to put your finger in the grass and, you know, maybe see some of that black goo still bubbling up. So it's still very much an active place where tar is finding its way to the surface.
Why are there so many fossils there? Did just creatures follow other creatures in this endless conga line of mistakes?
Yes. So, you know, these tar pits were, you know, sometimes could be quite shallow, even just a few feet deep. But the tar was so sticky that once you stepped in, it was very hard to remove your foot. And the more you fought, the more you became stuck. And so often what happened would be one animal would get stuck. It would start crying out. The predators would hear that cry, thinking, all right, I've got an easy meal here. They would show up. They would walk into the tar pits to get their snack, and then they too would become stuck. And it was just an endless cycle for, you know, 50,000 years. And so the pile of bodies that they've pulled out, you know, the number of specimens is incredible. I think even just the number of wolves they've pulled out is something like 1,000.
Jeez. Now, there's a story in your book about a human going in there.
Yeah,
now, I had never heard that before, and that was freaky.
Yeah, I mean, part of me when I was at La Brea Tar Pits, I was wondering, you know, you're seeing there are still, you know, lakes of tar there, and I was, you know, wondering what if I went in there? What would that be like? And not many people have gone in and come out alive, and as far as I know, there's only one, and he's a Los Angeles Police Department diver who went into the La Brea Tar Pits back in 2013. There was a murder case that the LAPD was working on, and they had gotten a tip that somebody had thrown a weapon used in that crime over the fence and into the La Brea Tar Pits, into one of the lakes near the road there. And they had their fancy equipment. They brought it in. They were able to look with some sonar equipment, and they could see the weapon at the bottom of this tar pit, but of course they couldn't get it. So this diver put on his diving suit, wetsuit, taped it all up with duct tape so that, you know, not too much of the tar could get to his skin. This is toxic material. It's pretty scary stuff. It eats through any kind of equipment. And so, you know, he was rightfully quite nervous about going in there.
Wasn't it also really hot?
It was. It's warm. It's okay. Warm. Yeah, but it's not boiling.
He can't see anything in there, can he?
No, you couldn't see his hand in front of his face, and so.
Oh my God.
He was lowered into the tar pits, and the guys were speaking to him through an earpiece with the sonar, saying, "Okay, a little bit left, a little bit right, a little bit deeper.
Oh,
going, you're close." And finally, he was in the tar pit for 77 minutes.
Whoa.
Yeah. And indeed, finally did find the weapon, but came up and, you know, he was a mess. His suit was, you know, torn to the point of not being usable anymore. His equipment was all messed up. Yeah, and he had a bit of a recovery time, too. It was a really incredible, incredible trip.
Some of the things that you found out about the Sureface cave bear were amazing. They had a huge range.
Yeah, I think, you know, like a lot of bears, you know, they wander around a lot, especially the males. Grizzly bears can, you know, have a home range of, you know, hundreds of miles. But one of the bear experts I talked to speculated that giant short-faced bears may have ranged thousands of miles.
Wow. Well, their fossils were found as far north as into Canada and the Yukon.
Right. And up in Alaska, there's... you know, the biggest collections of giant short-faced bear bones found so far have been in La Brea tar pits. There's about 30 different specimens there. Then up in Alaska, there's been 25 to 30 as well.
And how far east did they come?
They came all the way east. So they've been, you know, found throughout the Midwest, in the Southeast, in places like Missouri, and then into Pennsylvania, West Virginia. In 2010, there were some even found down in Florida, and even one specimen in northern Mexico.
Wow. Now, when they moved, they didn't move like we see black bears move. Black bears have this weird flat-footed motion, but they've figured out from their skeleton that they didn't move that way at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, they had front-facing feet. You know, often bears are a little bit pigeon-toed.
Yeah.
Grizzly bears and black bears, these had front-facing feet. And they think their gait may have been maybe more like kind of a camel's walk, where you have one side of their legs move, you know, the right front and back, back right move once, and then left and right and left and right.
Wow.
And so they think that these, you know, that may have really helped them be long-distance traveling animals. So they weren't great for sprinting. They weren't perhaps super fast, but what they could do was move across a big swath of land over time. And so big travelers able to find food. And if you think about their bodies, you know, weighing 2,000 pounds, they need to be able to go to where the food is and get those calories. And so they need to be able to, if there's not food where they are, they need to travel where that food is.
Well, you talked to several researchers, and they think that they weren't solely carnivorous, that they're, in fact, omnivorous. They sort of took advantage to whatever they came across.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people, in their imagination, bears are these big carnivorous, you know, meat-eating predators. And really, the truth is more complicated than that with a lot of bears, and I think that includes giant short-faced bears. So they were omnivores. They were, you know, they might scavenge a carcass that had already been killed. Certainly they were capable of killing animals, and I'm sure did. And I'm sure a fair bit, but they would eat plants, you know, depending on what their location was. So, they, you know, that big body of theirs, as I was saying, they need fuel, and so they had to find it and couldn't be too dependent on one particular food type.
Now, the big question, and you talk about this in the book, is was there ever human short-faced bear interactions that we know of?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what I'm fascinated by, you know, as a human on the planet is, you know, what would it be like to share this place with them?
I can the first thing that came to mind is walking across some long grass plains or something like that, and all of a sudden coming towards you is this hugely tall short-faced bear.
Yeah, I mean, one of the research one of the researchers whose work I was reading was a guy from Canada who was speculating that the movement of human beings coming from Alaska, you know, and Beringia into North America may have been impeded by the presence of short-faced bears.
Wow.
The fact that they were there made them rethink their decision maybe to move south. Maybe they saw them and said, nah, I think we'll stick here for a while and see if those bears move along.
I don't blame them. It's like, it's one of these creatures, like, you know, you don't want to be caught out in a big open space because you're not going to probably outrun it.
I think you're going to lose almost every time.
Yeah, exactly. And that brings up the other important topic that you talk about, and we only have like 2 minutes left. What caused the extinctions of all these Pleistocene beasts that live here? There's a lot of people, I think it's like Paul Martin, who I've interviewed, who believe it was humans that caused these extinctions.
Yeah, there's competing theories, and the shorter answers we still don't know yet, still being worked out. The theories are that humans wiped out all the megafauna at the end of the Pleistocene. One of them is that there was an outer space object.
Yeah, that was the first time I ever read it. It was in your book that there was a similar thing to the dinosaur extinctions.
Yeah, there was what they think was probably a comet that hit that unleashed fires and all sorts of other disasters that ended up killing a lot of these animals. There's speculation that there was disease that came in. But also at the time, the climate was changing and the vegetation was changing, really North America, from a lot of grasslands to more dense forests. And that made it more difficult probably for bears to hunt because you can't see as much. And the big prey species aren't as present in those forests as they are in the plains. So that's still very much an open question at this point.
We're completely out of time. I love this book. My guest tonight is Mike Stark, writer, journalist, and creative director for the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about his book, Chasing the Ghost Bear, On the Trail of America's Lost Super Beast. Mike, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.